As many of you know, Headliners is a monthly forum for engaged citizens interested in discussing current events with university faculty whose expertise illuminates the stories in the headlines. And this week's biggest story, of course, was the midterm election and the sweeping changes in both the U.S. and Minnesota House and Senate. Everyone's been talking about the new normal. And with this week's election results, the conversation changed just overnight. The economy, government spending, and job creation are now issues that we will be dealt with differently than during the past 2 years. And once again, national attention is trained on Minnesota as we lose our longest-serving member of Congress and prepare for the second statewide recount in as many years. We're getting quite good at this. Our speaker this evening has become a familiar and trusted figure to those of us who have been avidly following the campaigns over the past several months. She's appeared as a political commentator on media outlets ranging from Twin Cities Public Television to Fox 9 News. I'm sure many of you remember when she joined us 2 years ago to discuss the outcome of the presidential elections. In fact, Catherine, when I announced a month or so ago that you were coming tonight, there was an audible gasp of anticipation for this. We remember you well. And now she's had all of 48 hours to analyze the very different results of what President Obama has been calling his shellacking in this year's polls. So we're looking forward to this. Catherine Pearson is professor of political science at the University of Minnesota, where she specializes in congressional elections, women in politics, and public opinion. She earned her PhD from the University of California, Berkeley in 2005, where she won that year's Best Doctoral Dissertation Award from the American Political Science Association. She served as a research fellow at the Brookings Institution, and from 1993 to 98, she worked on Capitol Hill as a legislative assistant for two members of Congress. Currently, she's at work on a new book, Party Discipline in Contemporary Congress. Discipline, huh? Please join me in welcoming Professor Catherine Pearson. Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you for that kind introduction, and thank you all for being here tonight. So my first reaction is, what a difference 2 years makes. So 2 years ago, I was standing here talking about the 2008 elections and a major Democratic tide that had swept the nation for the second year in a row. And tonight, I will be talking about the 2010 elections and a Republican tidal wave. So political scientists often talk about whether or not elections tend to be local, candidate-centered affairs, or there's evidence of a partisan tide. In some elections, the adage, all politics is local, coined by former Speaker Tip O'Neill, seems to be apt. And then in others, all of the seat changes tend to go in one direction. And so these are what's known as partisan tides. But I think it's fair to say this year there was a Republican tidal wave with some pretty massive gains and Democratic losses in both chambers of Congress and in states across the country. So sort of briefly, just to talk about what happened, and then I'll talk about why these changes happened. Republicans, of course, this is the result of not sleeping very much in the last 48 hours. I was gonna talk about the typos that may appear. Well, of course, this should say Democrats lose majority party control in the House and Republicans gain 60 seats. That's embarrassing. But you all knew what I meant. This is an astute audience. Caught it before I did. So massive, as President Obama said, shellacking for Democrats with major Republican gains. Now, Republicans had needed a 39-seat gain and, of course, gained 60 seats in counting. There's still 10 races undecided. Republicans gained somewhere between 6 and 7 U.S. Senate seats, but Democrats hang on to majority party control with 52 or 53 seats. There will be at least 6 more Republican governors, if not more. Some states are still counting. And Republicans won the majority in both chambers of the Minnesota state legislature and in at least 17 other states. So this tidal wave was very much felt in pretty much every state in the country. Before the elections, Democrats had 255 seats in the House of Representatives. Now they're down to 186. So pretty massive. To talk about the Senate specifically, Republicans won, between 6 and 7 new seats, and they actually defeated incumbents Blanche Lambert Lincoln in Arkansas, and more well-known here, Russ Feingold in Wisconsin. Of course, Blanche Lambert Lincoln had survived a tough Democratic primary running as the centrist candidate in hopes that that would make her more electable in the general election, but she lost pretty soundly, and then Russ Feingold was behind pretty much the entire time going into this election and was soundly defeated. Republicans also won open seats after the Democratic incumbent had retired in North Dakota, Indiana, Illinois. Of course, this was President Obama's seat, where Richard Burris had been appointed for 2 years. That seat became open, and Mark Kirk, a Republican congressman, won that seat. And then, of course, Pennsylvania went to Pat Toomey, a very conservative Republican. In fact, the cause of Arlen Specter's change in party to the Democratic Party, thinking there was no way he could survive a primary against Pat Toomey. Well, he wouldn't have survived a primary against Pat Toomey. Who knows what would have happened in this election had he won the Democratic primary, but he lost to Joe Sestak, and that was a Republican pickup as well. Nonetheless, Democrats hung on in Nevada, California, Colorado, and probably the state of Washington. Patty Murray is in the fight of her life against Dino Rossi right now. And then Democrats were elected in democratically held open seats in Connecticut, Delaware, and West Virginia. And we'll talk a little bit more about Delaware, since analysis of media coverage has made clear that that was the most covered race in the entire country, even if not the closest. Okay, so of course Republicans gained the majority in the U.S. House with the biggest seat swing since 1948. And one of the things that's so interesting about the size of this seat swing is that the combination of redistricting patterns and partisan polarization has led a lot of political scientists over the last 10 years to say the size of seat swings that we used to see are virtually impossible today. Most districts are solidly locked in for one party or the other, and so we're just not going to see the type of seat swings that we used to see in the 1970s, the 1960s, 1948. But lo and behold, here we have a massive seat swing in the Republican direction after two consecutive years of Democratic seat swings. So The electorate is volatile after all, despite the fact that the majority of congressional districts are pretty solidly toward one party or the other. Interestingly, despite this massive tidal wave in the House, only about 110 seats were even considered competitive. So despite the fact that we've had a major shift and change in majority party control, it is also true that the majority of incumbents were reelected, slightly, obviously, lower rate than usual, but the majority were still reelected handily and actually did not face serious competition. Republicans won to get this 60-seat gain, 13 open seats held by Democrats, and then defeated 49 sitting Democratic incumbents. And that's pretty amazing. That's really a testament to the size of this Republican tidal wave that so many Democratic incumbents lost. Now, the majority of those incumbents who lost were Democratic incumbents who had won in either 2006 or 2008 for the first time. So they were the most vulnerable, both because they had the least service to tell their constituents about, and because they won those marginal districts, those districts that were competitive and led the Democrats to expand their majorities. But certainly one of the biggest defeats of the night in terms of the House of Representatives was Minnesota's Jim Oberstar. He was one of actually three Democratic committee chairs to lose on election night. And we don't think of committee chairs as losing re-election very often. The last time it really happened in any sizable number was in the 1994 election. So another tidal wave year with a lot of parallels. So this was This was a surprise to everyone. Even if some observers and Republican strategists were claiming they weren't surprised, it really was a surprise. The race had become competitive within the last couple of weeks. So certainly it became clear from an internal campaign poll that Chip Cravath's campaign released a couple weeks ago that this race had gotten tighter and that Jim Oberstar was perhaps facing the re-election battle of his life, but nonetheless, pretty much everyone thought he'd still win. So this race was removed from what it was ranked very safe, not at all competitive, by every House race ranking outlet, from Congressional Quarterly to the New York Times to the Cook Report. I mean, none of these reports that assess all 435 House districts even had this on their radar screen right up until the last couple of weeks. And then it became clear that, okay, Congressman Oberstar is going to have a smaller margin than he usually does. And so that might be a problem, you know, for him going forward, but he'll leak it out. Because after all, he had, his lowest margin had been 59%. And in 2008, he was actually reelected with 68% of the vote in a district that went 53% for Barack Obama. So none of the signs that political scientists typically look for thinking about a competitive race were there until the end. And furthermore, Oberstar raised $1.3 million more than did Chip Cravath, the man who beat him by about a percentage point. Outside groups did jump in at the very end, and they spent, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, about $332,000 on ads either promoting Cravath or criticizing Oberstar. And Oberstar did lose the endorsement of the Duluth, the major newspaper in Duluth. So it had gotten slightly competitive. But this is definitely an example of one of the seats that was a surprise to people, but nonetheless was caught up in this national tide. And Chairman Spratt and Skelton, the Budget Committee Chair and the House Armed Services Committee Chair, also lost their seats as well. So why did this happen? Tonight I want to sort of identify two types of factors that help explain midterm election results, or really any election results. And the first are underlying structural factors that really don't have a lot to do with how campaigns are waged. I know this is going to sound strange after seeing all the campaign ads and all the fundraising of this season, but political scientists actually debate whether or not campaigns matter. Now, I know that sounds crazy, but sort of this notion that there are these underlying structural forces, and if you know what those are in advance, the campaigns will wash each other out, they don't really matter. It's all about these structural forces. And so these would include midterm election effects, a poor economy, low presidential approval, and then just the underlying partisan identification of the electorate, which is actually relatively evenly divided across the country, with Democrats having a slight edge, but independents in 2010 really gave Republicans a huge edge. So, talking about these structural factors, well, the members of Congress of the president's party are more likely to lose in every midterm election. So, only in 2002 and in 1998, in the post-war era, have members of Congress of the president's party actually picked up seats. So in 2002, Republicans gained seats in the wake of 9/11, and President Bush enjoyed very high popularity at that point. And then in 1998, Democrats picked up a few seats as well. President Clinton, despite the fact that impeachment was really going on right then, actually was still pretty popular. So in general, the president's party loses seats in a midterm election. So from the moment President Obama was elected, before he even stepped into office, we would have predicted that Democrats would lose seats. But midterm losses vary dramatically depending on the state of the economy, presidential approval, and then the number of marginal seats, the number of seats that are competitive for one party or the other. And in 2008, Democrats actually won 49 House seats that were also won by McCain. So in general, there is an average loss in midterm elections of 14 House seats for the president's party when presidential approval is above 50%, and an average loss of 36 seats when presidential approval is below 50%. So the party of the president, even in good times, typically loses seats in the midterm, but the number of losses are what varies. So first, thinking about the economy. So this is a figure calculated by a political scientist at Emory University, and it's a little bit hard to sort of discern, but the dots represent different election years, and the regression line basically shows that there's a positive and statistically significant relationship between the change in real disposable income and the change in House seats. And over on the left-hand axis, the number is actually going up. So as the change in real disposable income is positive, the number of House seats approaches zero. In other words, fewer members of Congress of the president's party lose when the economy is good. And that just plots all of the different midterm elections to sort of prove that point. Same type of graph for presidential approval. So when the president's approval is positive, there is a lower change in House seats, and that this is an even stronger statistically significant relationship with midterm elections plotted as well. Perhaps easier to follow. This basically just tracks the fact that President Obama's approval has been declining pretty much since the day he was sworn in. And this isn't uncommon, but nonetheless, it had declined to a level that made it difficult for members of his own party to campaign and ultimately win re-election. So he started out in the first quarter at about 63% on average. This is calculated by Gallup's daily tracking polls. And then by the seventh quarter, he was down to 44.7% calculated from the daily tracking polls. So essentially, Democrats went into election night with the president who had well below 50% in terms of approval ratings. Now, these approval ratings are nowhere near as low as President Bush's approval ratings were in 2006. But then remember, 2006 is the year that Democrats gained majority control in both the House and the Senate. So turning away from the structural factors that put Democrats at a disadvantage from the start, there are also campaign effects and short-term forces that matter as well. In this election, we saw the effects of several of those. The first was fundraising. So this election, the 2010 cycle, set records for spending in a midterm election. The last midterm cycle, congressional candidates, parties, and outside groups spent $2.85 billion. And this cycle, they're on track to spend $4 billion or more. And this includes, although I suspect the total will ultimately be higher, spending by independent groups. And independent groups spent a lot of money in 2006 as well, but they've dramatically increased the amount of spending that they're doing, in part because of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. And if people have questions about that, I'm happy to talk about it. I just want to emphasize the point that independent group spending is not new, but the fact that corporations, labor unions, and associations can now make contributions directly, not to candidates, to independent groups or themselves independently of candidates, but now that they can do this directly from their treasuries, it has increased the spending. And they also are likely to do this through 501c4 and C6 groups, which don't require them to actually list who their contributors are. And so I think that has increased the amount of spending as well. And whereas Republican and Democratic candidates, there was not a huge amount of difference between the candidate spending of candidates of the same party. The Republican groups outspent Democratic groups by about 7-1. In terms of partisan enthusiasm, that was definitely a big factor in this campaign, even though the underlying partisanship of the electorate favors Democrats slightly. There was a partisan gap that I'll show you some data about in a minute. And certainly GOTV efforts and party unity were stronger on the Republican side as well. And then further, the campaign messages were much harder for Democrats. Republicans ran against President Obama, they ran against Nancy Pelosi, and they ran against health care. Democrats in competitive races also ran against health care and also ran against Nancy Pelosi. So it was a very confusing message and hard for, and in some cases also ran against President Obama. So it was harder for Democrats to really articulate a winning message. It was hard for Democrats to say, okay, but President Bush got us into this mess 2 years ago because voters were already blaming the incumbent president who had been in office for 2 years. So I think Republicans also won the message war as well. And that was obvious in these data collected by Gallup, which basically show that the congressional vote, the connection between individuals' congressional vote and how they felt about President Obama was higher in this election than it had been in previous elections. So 24% of the electorate as of late October were voting for a congressional candidate to send the message that they support the president, whereas 38% were voting to send a message that they oppose the president. 37% were voting for a congressional candidate not to send a message either way. But really, when you think about the fact that President Obama's not actually on the ballot, that's a relatively low number, especially compared to some of the other midterm cycles up there. So that was definitely caused problems for Democrats as well, who didn't necessarily get their own message out, even if they were running as an independent voice, sort of the party of the president. That's what they always say in midterm elections. I'm running as an independent voice. Well, it didn't work. People were still voting against President Obama in larger numbers. And then pollsters also identified a pretty distinct enthusiasm gap that gave Republicans about a 5-7% edge. And what I have displayed on the screen here is courtesy of Nate Silver. It was published in the New York Times. But basically, these are exit poll data that show the partisan gap in the majority of states where data was collected was in the Republicans' favor. Basically, what Nate Silver did was he looked at the exit polls and he compared the actual presidential vote of the respondents in 2008 to the presidential candidate for whom Tuesday's voters claimed that they had voted, and then looked at the 26 states where exit polls were conducted to compare them. Now, unfortunately, Minnesota isn't up here because there was no exit poll conducted in Minnesota. The 26 states where exit polls were conducted tended to be states where there was also a Senate race. So unfortunately, we don't have data from Minnesota, which is too bad, especially given the fact that the governor's race actually really isn't even over. But anyway, nationally, on Tuesday night, voters told exit pollsters that they had split their vote about 45% to 45% between Barack Obama and John McCain. And remember, the actual margin 2 years ago was 7 points. And so that essentially means the Democrats were at a 7-point deficit when it came to voter turnout. So one of the questions that has been raised both before and after this election is, what was the effect of the Tea Party? Did the Tea Party help the Republicans? Did the Tea Party hurt the Republicans? And the answer is yes. So if you think about back to primary season, when Tea Party endorsed candidates won Republican primaries in some key states, we can trace some ways in which the candidate selection process led to defeats in some competitive races that could have otherwise helped Republicans gain control of the Senate along with the House. And incidentally, this is the first time since 1933 where when the House has flipped parties, the Senate hasn't gone with it. So it is pretty striking that the Senate stayed in Democratic control, although the candidates matter more in Senate races than they do in House races. So turning to Nevada. Now, if the Republican Party-endorsed candidate had won that primary, this race could have turned out differently. Sharron Angle was viewed as too extreme, and she basically allowed Harry Reid to remain competitive in a race that had already, in which he had already been written off completely. And actually win. Christine O'Donnell, an even more stark example of this, she defeated Congressman Mike Castle in the Republican primary in Delaware. And what was particularly striking about this is Congressman Mike Castle had represented all of Delaware as a congressman for 18 years. And he had been governor before that, and he enjoyed re-election rates statewide of about 70%. I knew him when I worked on the Hill, just the very nice man, moderate Republican, would have been a shoo-in to the U.S. Senate. In fact, the Democratic candidate, Chris Coons, was not the Democrats' first choice. I mean, no one else really ran against him. But Democrats actually couldn't recruit someone that they thought would be really great because, essentially, Democrats had already concluded that Mike Castle was just going to win that race. But Mike Castle was ousted on primary night by Christine O'Donnell, who received more coverage for her views about witchcraft and masturbation and all sorts of other topics, which really don't seem that relevant in a congressional race, and was pretty soundly defeated on Tuesday night. Ken Buck narrowly lost in Colorado, another Tea Party candidate, and it seems as though Joe Miller, a Sarah Palin Tea Party candidate, will likely lose to incumbent Republican write-in candidate Lisa Murkowski, though who knows how the actual vote counting will go and if enough people can spell her name right. But it appears as though she had the lead. So there were about 129 Tea Party candidates or Tea Party endorsed candidates. I should make clear, these are all Republican candidates, but Tea Party supported and endorsed candidates in the House, and 30 of them won Democratic seats, which if you say 30 out of 129, that's not so impressive. But when you say 30 out of 60, that's actually hugely impressive, that half of the Republican gains appeared to come from Tea Party supported candidates. And then I'll talk about voters here in a minute, but one of the interesting things here was some data calculated by a political scientist about challenger quality. This graph shows the percentage of each party's challengers with previous electoral experience. And so one of sort of Democrats' hope about this election cycle was that by having so many challengers endorsed by the Tea Party, they wouldn't bring with them a lot of electoral experience and therefore be more likely to be defeated. But actually, the gap between the electoral experience of the Democratic and Republican challengers in most years is pretty slim, but then in 2010, it's actually pretty big. It's also big in 2008, but it widens in 2010, showing that a greater percentage of Republican challengers actually had previous electoral experience than did Democratic challengers. That's also the function of the fact that Democrats thinking about challenging a Republican incumbent knew it would be a bad year for Democrats, and so those with electoral experience were least likely to run. But what about voters? So voters in general, the voters who identified with the Tea Party definitely gave Republicans a boost. So there's sort of two stories to this. So if you look at exit poll data coming out of 2010, it shows that 4 in 10 voters told exit pollsters on Tuesday that they supported the Tea Party movement. So that's actually a pretty big chunk of the electorate. But by the same token, if you look at a national sample, as the New York Times did in a New York Times CBS poll done in mid-September, and then they also report the results from April and May as well, you can see that actually the Tea Party only has is only judged favorably by about 20% of the electorate and not favorably by about 25% of the electorate, and then a majority of voters either don't know, don't care, haven't heard enough. A smaller percentage of voters said that they would be more likely to vote for a Tea Party-supported candidate than less likely. And then in terms of actual identification as a supporter of the Tea Party movement, those numbers hover around 20% with a little bit of a spike in July and August. So thinking about the electorate broadly, it's only about a fifth that's supportive, even fewer who are more inclined to vote for someone. But yet, again, more evidence of this gap in enthusiasm in terms of voter turnout, 4 in 10 voters on Tuesday night do support the Tea Party movement. So definitely it seems as though the Tea Party movement, while not widespread in the electorate, did give Republicans an edge on Tuesday, even if it cost them some critical Senate seats. So what about voters and vote choice in midterm elections? Well, about 40% of the electorate in general votes in midterm elections. In Minnesota, the number is about 60%. The latest estimates I have seen about Minnesota come from Michael McDonald. He calculates turnout rates in every state and nationally every 2 years. And his estimate for Minnesota on Tuesday night is 56.8%. That's lower than Mark Ritchie's estimate. So I'm not actually sure what the number is. So take that with a grain of salt. But the number 41.5% in the U.S. and 56.8% in Minnesota come from the same sources. And that 56.8% in Minnesota for Tuesday night is the highest voter turnout in the country. Once again, after 2006 and 2008, with Minnesota voting at the highest rate in the nation. So in general, partisans vote for their party, and independents are the critical swing in an election. In this election cycle, it was clear that independents swayed very Republican. And then, of course, the question always comes up about what about undecided voters, people who vote at the last minute? And in general, these are not people who are particularly thoughtful and weighing all of the information until the last minute. They are people who are not paying attention until the last minute and may or may not vote. And so I just sort of wanted to take a minute to dispel this myth of this thoughtful independent voter. I know they're out there. We may even have some in this audience. And Tom Horner certainly hoped that a majority of Minnesotans would be this thoughtful independent voter. But the bottom line is most people who are not affiliated with the two major parties are not affiliated because they just don't think about politics that much. And I'm sure I'm offending someone out there who is a notable exception, but survey data show that in survey after survey, people who are more attentive to politics, more engaged, participate more often, and more knowledgeable tend to self-identify with one of the two parties more strongly. Okay. Exit polls from Tuesday night. And again, keep in mind that Minnesota is not in this sample, but these are U.S. exit polls and that they combine the 26 states that were in the survey. So in every group that is described on this slide and in every other group that I found, all of these groups voted more strongly Republican than they did in 2008. The only group for whom there is not a noticeable shift, there's a slight shift, but not a noticeable shift, is African Americans, who did in general not trend more Republican. But every other group did. 58% of voters 65 and over voted Republican, which was definitely a blow to Democrats. Blue-collar voters tended Democratic, Republican. The biggest gap ever recorded in exit polls. In terms of the gender gap, it was the smallest gap recorded. Since 1980, there's been a marked gender gap in which women are much more likely to vote for the Democratic candidate than men. And while that is still true in this cycle, the differences were smaller. And then this is the biggest gap, partisan gap among whites that has been discerned from exit polls to date, where 60% of whites voted Republican and 38% Democratic. Unfortunately, I don't have the crosstabs for these exit poll data. This is just what is reported, so I can't break it down further than that because they haven't released it yet. But this is a pretty good snapshot, I think, of what happened on Tuesday night. Now, briefly, turning to the Minnesota governor's race. Had to put these slides together. Well, like all of them, sort of at the last minute, but this one in particular. So this is what the Secretary of State's website said the day after the election. Mark Dayton, with a lead that is smaller than the critical half of 1% of voters who voted. So what does this mean? Well, we've all heard the news. So we've moved on to the phase where at the local level, all of the precincts are collecting their votes. They're not actually recounting them per se, but they're just making sure they got it right. This is the same thing that happened in 2008. And so they're getting all the ballots together, and they will report their official numbers to the Secretary of State's office before November 23rd, and then the canvassing board at the state level will meet to total these initial results. And at that point, if the margin is still less than half of 1%, there will be an automatic recount of the ballots. So the state pays for it, the taxpayers pay for it, and it's automatic, no political wrangling over whether or not this will happen. If Mark Dayton gains a little over 1,500 votes, because the half percent would be about 10,300 votes, then that will trigger then it wouldn't trigger this recount automatically. Tom Emmer could still ask for and pay for a recount or a partial recount, but if it's within that 10,300 window, which it is now, there would be an automatic recount, at which point the ballots would go back out to the counties, and at the county level, each of the 87 counties would recount all of the ballots. We sort of remember what happened 2 years ago. Each campaign, each party would have their lawyers, have their observers there, and be prepared to challenge ballots if they think that, in fact, the voter really didn't intend to vote for whoever it was counted for or whoever the recounters were indicating. There were many, many challenges 2 years ago. It took the three-judge panel at the time a lot of time to go through all of those challenges. Some of us watched it on uptake. We remember the lizard people ballots. But the good thing about the 2008 experience is that there was a change in the law that makes it harder to challenge a ballot because of a so-called identifying mark. So in 2008, ballots were challenged because there was a stray pencil mark off to the side. And one of the campaigns, of course, the campaign that didn't get that vote, said, oh, you know, that's an identifying mark. Someone is trying to indicate that stray pencil mark, they'd know that that means Catherine Pearson and that's, you know, she's trying to send a signal of how she voted. And so that sort of issue has been resolved. To be disqualified because of a so-called identifying mark, there must actually be a name or a signature on the ballot that identifies the voter. Also, another critical issue from 2008 was the counting of absentee ballots. The counting of absentee ballots was done in each jurisdiction, and that led to the possibility that different election officials would interpret absentee ballot requirements differently. So now they will all be counted in one centralized location, so that won't be a problem where one of the campaigns can't say, you know, but the absentee voters in your liberal county were much less stringent than they were in my conservative county, possibly skewing the results. So that won't be an issue this time. There's already been a four-judge panel appointed to review the disputed ballots. And so now we're looking at sometime in December. And after that, who knows what will happen? Court challenges, who knows? Also, who knows what the margin will be? And I think a lot will depend on actually how big the difference is between the two candidates. So thinking back to 2008, the day after the election, Coleman was ahead by 215 votes. Ultimately, Al Franken won by 312 votes. So we're talking about very, very narrow margins there. We're not talking about nearly 9,000 votes, which is currently Mark Dayton's lead. In 1962, in the recount with Elmer Anderson and Carl Rolvag, the ultimate difference was 91 votes. Again, a very small margin. And we don't have a small margin here. But we do have a lot of charges already flying through the airwaves coming from Republican Party Chair Tony Sutton that this election was, you know, that there's something dishonest about this election. And how could it be that Tom Emmer didn't win in a year when both chambers flipped and Jim Oberstar, he's been there since 1974, lost? Well, Tom Horner. But anyway, I digress. We can talk about that in Q&A. Okay, so what does this mean for redistricting in Minnesota? What does this mean for redistricting across the country? The election results on Tuesday night will have huge implications for the next 10 years because, of course, it's election years ending in Two, where the first set of new legislative seats, new congressional seats, come into play. So it's the governors who are elected on Tuesday night, it's the legislatures who are elected on Tuesday night that will ultimately decide the new district lines. And so to throw some data that come from the Rose Institute in Claremont, California. So state legislatures propose the new districts, and then governors sign them into law. So having a unified government of one party hugely advantages that party in the drawing of district lines. Having divided government, a legislature of one party, a governor of another, means that redistricting may be more of an incumbent protection plan than a partisan gerrymander to really benefit the party with unified government. But after Tuesday night, there is unified Republican government in around 17 states. It could be more, with some governorships not yet called. So what this means is that 196 of 435 congressional districts will be drawn by these unified Republican states, or they'll come from these unified Republican states. That doesn't mean they'll all be Republican districts, of course, but it means that Republicans will be advantaged in the process for these seats. Looking at unified Democratic government, that will be in around seven states, maybe more, maybe less. But assuming that seven is the sort of correct guess as things stand now, that only amounts to 49 congressional districts. So that's a pretty big and significant difference. And then six states have nonpartisan redistricting commissions, so they don't factor in at all. So this essentially means that the next 10 years could see a lot of districts in which Republican candidates win by about 55% to 60% of the vote, because that's a pretty efficient congressional district. You want to make sure your margin is big enough that you don't lose in a tidal wave year, but yet you don't want it to be so big that you're wasting votes. So, you know, Keith Ellison winning by, huge margins, Betty McCollum winning by huge margins. Essentially, Democrats would argue, they're wasted votes in their districts. You could also make that argument about John Klein's district as well. And Michelle Bachmann's district as well. So basically, in a gerrymander, the parties want the districts to be as efficient as possible so that they ensure the reelection of their party's incumbent, but that they don't waste a lot of votes that could be spread out into a district to help someone out. So definitely the elections have very clear implications for redistricting. Finally, political scientists and journalists definitely disagree about the meanings of elections. You know, you hear the M word circulated a lot the morning after an election. It's a mandate for this. It's a mandate for that. This means, you know, that voters want healthcare repealed. Last time I checked, healthcare repeal was not actually on the ballot. Not actually on the ballot at all. And so it's hard to discern from any election that voters want healthcare repealed or healthcare passed in the first place, for that matter. But for a politician to claim a policy mandate, that assumes very knowledgeable citizens. Now, most people, as I mentioned, vote on the basis of party identification. Now, obviously, that wasn't the only source of voting in this particular election. But not all Republican candidates campaigned on healthcare repeal. They all campaigned on the economy, which was very efficient, which was very strategic. So how you can read into this election that there's a mandate for healthcare repeal, I don't know. And then it also assumes clear and differing positions from candidates, which I think in this election, in many cases, was the case. But in some of these competitive elections, we actually saw the majority of Democrats who voted against healthcare lose. So what does that tell you? That they were in competitive districts and tried to insulate themselves from the president, but it doesn't tell you that those voters want healthcare reform to be repealed. Certainly, elections are, to some extent, judgments of performance. People do vote retrospectively to think about the future going forward. But there's less of that in midterm elections, when it tends to be about the economy and about the president rather than about many of the candidates on the ballot. So I would argue, based on political science research and survey data, that this was not an election that provided a mandate for the Republicans' pledge to America. You know, they have this pledge where they talk about tax cuts, constitutionality, requirements for legislation, but I don't think that most voters had any idea that that's what they were campaigning on. We saw this in 1994 with the contract with America. That was a more precise plan. It actually had 10 pieces of legislation that Republicans guaranteed that they would bring forward, and so those 10 pieces of legislation were brought forward by Speaker Newt Gingrich, but that didn't necessarily compute into a mandate, and only about 20% of people had even heard of the contract with America, which was much more visible. And then finally, these data from the New York Times show pretty clearly that disapproval of President Obama and Democrats in Congress should not be mistaken for support for congressional Republicans. I have to read my slide here. But with the question, do you approve or disapprove of the way Republicans in Congress are handling their jobs, 73% of the electorate disapproved of the way Republicans were handling their jobs as of September. So again, I think the idea that this is a mandate for Republicans is not accurate, but it certainly is, you know, about disapproval of the president and about concern over the economy. Thinking about the 112th agenda, Congress, this will obviously affect President Obama's agenda. We're seeing partisan polarization in the last 10 years that's been higher than it ever has been, and there's no reason to think that this will go away anytime soon. The majority of votes in the last Congress saw the two parties pitted against each other, and both parties, on average, their members supported their party about 90% or 91% of the time. So record high levels of partisan support for members of Congress, even those facing tough re-election. Whoops. The Republican leadership will now have to deal with the challenges of governing, not just criticizing. It looks like that we will have a Speaker John Boehner, a congressman from Ohio who's been in Congress for about 20 years. I think the question for Minnesotans that we might be interested in is, will we have a Republican conference chair, Michelle Bachmann? She has announced that she is challenging Jeb Hensarling for the position of conference chair. Whether or not Pelosi will be minority leader, I think, remains to be seen. And whether or not we will have obstruction in the Senate, there is no question we will. There were record high numbers of filibusters in the last Congress, and with a narrower Democratic majority, there's no reason to think that we won't reach a new record in the 112th Congress. But finally, is there any good news for Democrats? Midterm results do not predict the outcome of subsequent presidential elections. Just think back to 1994. Democrats lost control of the House for the first time in 40 years and control of the Senate, and President Obama cruised to re-election 2 years later. The public's view of Republicans is negative. Republican victories very well may enhance the influence of the right wing of the party and the Tea Party and produce a lot of internal conflict. And although the electorate on Tuesday night definitely shifted Republican in a pretty dramatic way, demographic trends continue to favor the Democratic Party. So certainly young people and minority voters are a growing part of the voting eligible population. Whether or not they'll be a part of the electorate in 2012 remains to be seen, but those demographic trends continue to favor the Democratic Party. Whew. Okay, I'd love to take questions now.
That was pretty awesome for 48 hours of analysis. Oh my goodness. Yeah, exactly. So more partisan politics. Oh, joy, oh, joy. What kind of questions do you have for Catherine? Here we go, right in the middle. In the middle of the room here.
Your figure...
Oh, thank you.
your figure of 62% of blue-collar high school graduates, was it, that voted Republican... is really an interesting figure because it seems to me that they are voting against their own their own ideas when they vote for the Republicans. They just seem to want to do themselves in every time they vote.
And this is often a comment after elections. It's sort of the "what's the matter with Kansas" question that's the title of a book. I'm not specifically criticizing Kansas, and there's something to that. There's also something to turnout, and also something to party identification. I mean, probably many of these voters do identify with the Republican Party to begin with, but probably also many of them are particularly distressed and particularly affected by the economy and see voting against President Obama, who has, one would argue, been in charge of the economy, sort of never mind where it came from, for the last 2 years. And so I think a lot of this is about economics, but not in a way, not in the way that you describe, but voting against the party in power because of economic distress, unemployment, and uncertainty.
We have a question way in the back here.
Were you able to discern any regional differences in this tidal wave, any north, south, east, west kinds of things?
You know, that's a great question. And I looked at the maps of where, you know, where the House seats flipped. And certainly the areas where Democrats made gains in 2006 and 2008, that was evident. But the Democratic losses really were spread out through most of the country, less so on the very western edge of the country. But after 2008, everyone had pretty much written off New England for Republicans forever. Well, actually, many of the Republican pickups were in House and Senate seats in New England. So as it turned out, you know, that's not the case. Just like Democrats have, some say, written off the South, which is, you know, not quite an accurate statement either. So I guess in answer to your question, not really, in the sense that economic distress was spread pretty widely, as were the congressional seats that flipped.
Probably except for Kansas, right? I'm
no,
from Kansas,
some flipped
there too. Say that. Way in the back on the right here.
As a political scientist, what do you think, in hindsight, 2020 is always perfect hindsight, right? If you look back, what would you recommend that President Obama and his administration could have done differently, the top one, two, or three things that they could have done differently to have avoided or prevented this?
That's a great and a very challenging question. So I think midterm losses, no matter what President Obama did, were unavoidable. But the size of the tidal wave, if there was a magic answer to improving the economy more quickly, I mean, there are definitely economists who would argue that the stimulus package should have been much bigger and much more focused on jobs. Well, I'm not sure how it could have been any bigger to actually make it through the House and the Senate. It pretty much made it through both chambers by the narrowest of margins. But I think hindsight would suggest that it should have been bigger and should have focused on more jobs. And then there's so much in the media about, you know, this is the president should just have a better message, a better message, a better message. And I think that that explanation is massively overplayed, but yet I think it's still true. I think that the message of the economy should have been clearer from day one, because that really fundamentally was what this election was about. And, you know, should Democrats have avoided health care? I don't think so. There already was an enthusiasm gap, and if they hadn't passed health care, it might have even been greater, although they certainly ran away from it in the election. And again, I'm not sure that was a smart this is why I'm not a political strategist. I'm a political scientist. But I think the bottom line is to really focus on the economy and the economic message from day one.
I thought I learned in high school that gerrymandering was unconstitutional, and I've seen maps of congressional districts with more arms and legs than the typical gerrymander that I saw in the textbook.
So gerrymandering is actually not unconstitutional. So in 1962, in Baker versus Carr, the Supreme Court ruled that it is an issue that they can adjudicate, that it's justiciable, that, you know, this is something they can actually rule on, whereas before they had said things like, we are not going to get into that political thicket. So there have been a series of Supreme Court cases that have looked at gerrymandering. And the only instances in which the Supreme Court has been actually willing to throw out congressional districts have to do with majority-minority districts. So in the mid-90s, the Supreme Court threw out several districts that had been drawn after the 1990 census that really were just sort of these, you know, crazy Z-shaped districts or districts in North Carolina that went 100 miles down a freeway and you could pretty much open your doors at parts, and that was the district, because those districts were specifically drawn on the basis of race. And so they threw those out and said, you cannot draw districts specifically on the basis of race. There have to be other factors as well. But the Supreme Court has ruled in many cases that partisan gerrymandering, so they took up the case Davis versus Bandemir for an Indiana redistricting where Republicans had a massive edge in the number of congressional districts, even though the state at the time was relatively even. California, massive Democratic edge, vastly outnumbering the Democratic to Republican divide. And in all of these Supreme Court cases, including the most recent Supreme Court case having to do with the mid-cycle Texas partisan gerrymander, where once Republicans had unified control mid-decade in Texas, they redrew the lines. In all of those cases, the Supreme Court has said, this is an issue that we can rule on, but these districts are not so egregious that we're going to throw them out. In other words, we leave open the possibility that there's a partisan gerrymander that's so bad that we'll force it out, but we haven't seen it yet.
In the back here.
So, one of the things we've heard about Obama and the disapproval rating of him is that he lacks an emotional resonance with the population. But we know from history that the most successful presidents are those that are most comfortable in their own skin and being in the office. So what does Obama do to address that?
Yeah, that's a great question that I don't have a good answer to. I don't know. Where is the Obama that was on the campaign trail, who clearly was very comfortable with large crowds and clearly connected with audiences? And I don't know, because he is obviously a policy wonk, very much involved with policy, the ins and outs, but sort of, where's the Bill Clinton link between the two? I don't know. But I will say that after the 1994 elections, people were saying, is President Clinton even relevant anymore? You know, isn't this just about, you know, Newt Gingrich, who is more like a prime minister these days than a president? So if we look back to the media surrounding the 1994 elections, people were, you know, really raising questions sort of like this about different things about flaws of Bill Clinton's, but that would have suggested that he would have been an ineffective one-term president. Clinton and Obama are obviously different people, so who knows if this will follow the same trajectory. But we'll see. I suspect we'll also have a whole new host of advisors to the president very soon.
In the back, on the far right here.
Do you see a relationship between election results and state unemployment figures? For example, Michigan now has a Republican governor, and Ohio has a Republican governor.
The short answer is yes. In general, the answer is yes. The data haven't been collected specifically for this election to sort of give you a systematic answer, but anecdotally, absolutely, sort of overall in general, yes. The more economic distress there is, the stronger the unrest about the economy. But having said that, there also has been research that shows that it's not just about people's own economic situation. So pocketbook voting, you know, specifically the question, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? There's an element of that, but it's also, to an even greater extent, sociotropic voting, which has to do with not just your financial situation, but the economy around you. But to the extent that the state economy also has a great effect on people in addition to the national economy, a bad state economy is going to have sort of multiply that, or at least add to that effect that a bad national economy is going to have. But it's not just how am I doing personally. It's the economy more generally.
Since elections seem to be swinging more based on the independent undecided voter versus the partisan voter, and your point that those kind of independent undecided are less well-informed, maybe less philosophically based, how do you influence that population except through the negative big money ads?
Well, I think you just gave the answer that most campaigns utilize, the negative ads. And I do want to defend negative ads for just a minute. I know, that I won't get a lot of support here, but political science research about negative ads actually shows that they provide a lot more information about both candidates' policy positions and voting records and proposals than do these sort of generic positive ads. I have several children. Mm-hmm. I'm committed to the future. I care about the public. Sort of flowery, I love my family ads. I mean, that doesn't really tell you much. But the ads in which one candidate is saying negatively, darkly, my opponent voted against that. My opponent voted against this. My opponent wants to take away your Social Security. My opponent wants to take away your health care. Those may be exaggerations, to be fair. But then they often will actually have the specific vote to which they are referring and provide some information. And then the candidate will say, this is my plan for Social Security. This is my plan for the economy. And negative ads do differ from ad to ad, but a political scientist went through and did a content analysis of every negative ad for several election cycles and actually found that the majority of them do provide information to the voters. Now, the problem, of course, is when they stretch the facts. There's no media outlet that's actually doing any checks. The opponent doesn't have enough money to run a counter ad that says they stretch the truth, and so there's no real dialogue. And it also, some research shows, turns exactly those voters that you're talking about, the independents, off from politics, whereas the people who are already excited about politics remember those ads and either, get really mad about them because they're attacking their person, or they, believe everything they say. So ads do play an important role. But grassroots, get out the vote activities actually can make a difference. A lot of campaigns, would rather spend money on ads because, frankly, if you have the money, it's easier than getting a field team. But again, political science research shows that door-to-door contact by people actually does increase voter turnout. There was a study that showed in Connecticut that it increased voter turnout by about 5% in a randomized experimental sample to have get out the vote people actually going door to door. So you're talking about persuading people to vote for a specific candidate, but I think that there is room for a dialogue with people who actually go door to door. And the Obama campaign in 2008 employed a lot of volunteer strategies very successfully in actually making voter person-to-person contact.
Don't you love all these questions? They are terrific. Question in the back next.
Yes. Could you tell me what your insight might be about the young vote in this election compared to, like, the last election, certainly President Obama carried a large share of the, college kids that voted in the mm-hmm. election. And do you have any insight whether they participated in this election and to what extent?
It looks like the answer is they did not participate at a very high level. And actually, 2008 is interesting. The percentage of the electorate that was comprised of the 18 to 25-year-olds actually only went up a percentage point or two, but the overall voter turnout also went up. So young people were they exceeded the increase that the rest of the population had in 2008 and went so overwhelmingly for Obama that they were a critical part of Obama's coalition. And so the fact that young people – I've seen stories with these headlines, although I haven't actually seen the data, but the stories suggest that young people did not vote at anywhere near the rate that they did in 2008. I mean, no one did, but even proportionally. And, I just don't think young people are particularly excited about midterm elections or the candidates, that they don't feel like, they don't feel like they speak to them or their issues.
Some of them were thinking about midterm exams that week, too, which was a big problem here. But, Margie, a question over there.
Redistricting. How did those six states, I know it's a small number, but those six states end up with their nonpartisan redistricting mm-hmm. commission, and are we ever going to add any states to that group?
That's a great question. and if I had the power to do it, that's a great question. And I think the answer is yes, because we are seeing some ballot propositions on states with ballot propositions that allow for redistricting commissions. And so I do think that voters are beginning to express a preference for better government in that way. Redistricting commissions are typically former judges in independent bodies that look at the data and try to draw lines based on sort of compact, contiguous districts that respect like-minded communities. But it, even without gerrymandering, sort of the partisan sorting that has gone on in the U.S. still is going to create a lot of partisan districts. And so definitely nonpartisan independent commissions are helpful, but they're not gerrymandering isn't the only source of polarization. I mean, it would be tough to draw a competitive district that includes Minneapolis. You're just not going to get two-party competition. It would be tough to draw a competitive district in many rural parts of the country where a Democrat could compete very well. And so there are just sort of naturally, based on where people live, going to be a lot of districts that aren't competitive. But redistricting commissions would definitely be helpful. And if you've ever seen Iowa, it has the oldest one. I mean, Iowa is sort of rectangular, but their districts are also rectangular. They're really amazing. But having said that, Iowa's incumbency reelection rate is only slightly below the national average. But yeah, I think a movement by individuals in states with propositions is the first step, and then I don't know how you get it in Minnesota.
Just wondered if voters approach different offices on the ballot differently. For instance, the Minnesota ballot, if you look at auditor, state auditor, attorney general, secretary of state, those all went quite clearly Democratic. It almost as if voters went in and traditionally just pulled the ballot according or pulled the lever according to tradition. But then when you came to the sexier votes or those that had to do with that had a lot of media backing or perhaps seemed to indicate that this is where the economy is or is not, I'm voting for where I am not and where I want to be, then the vote was different.
Yeah, and that's a great question. I mean, in general, the less information a voter has about an office or a candidate, and that's what happens with these lower-level offices, the more they will rely on cues, whether they're the cues of incumbency or the cues of party. And so I think, you know, certainly for Rebecca Otto, Lori Swanson, I mean, you know, obviously a competitive year in Minnesota between the two parties, obviously, but they both win pretty easily. And I think that's a function of an incumbency advantage, no major scandal, running an active reelection campaign. And then Mark Ritchie, I mean, also an incumbency advantage, but also the advantage of unanimous Supreme Court decisions, definitely getting a lot of praise in general, not yesterday, but in general, for the way that he handled the recount. So those races really weren't big surprises. You know, most voters didn't have a lot of information. I should say not the the voters for whom there wasn't a lot of information, and the incumbency advantage, I think, played a big role. That doesn't really answer the question about state legislative office, though, because obviously the incumbency advantage was not so effective for many of the incumbents who were ousted there. I think, party identification matters. But then my sense is that, you know, many of the districts in which Republican legislators defeated DFL incumbents, those were districts where, you know, that were responsible for the DFL taking control of the House in 2006. Those were sort of swing districts to begin with, and districts where both candidates were waging active campaigns. So voters did actually have information about both candidates from door knocking, literature, and were considered pretty closely contested elections. And then the Republican wave was helpful to the Republican candidates there as well.
You're just a gold mine of information. All these questions keep flowing. We have one in the back here.
A question on proportional voting. Tom Horner has been cast as a spoiler in this election, and I'd like your comments on that. But two related questions. If we actually had a strong third or even fourth party, wouldn't that prevent the two existing major parties from just selecting the extremes? You know, so we select between extremes. And if we had significant numbers of independent people actually elected, wouldn't it force discussion and compromise rather than the situation we see now?
So that, yeah, I'm surprised this question hasn't come up until now. So obviously the status of Independence Party candidates, Tom Horner's race, Peter Hutchinson in 2006, Jesse Ventura, Minnesota often has an Independence Party candidate on its congressional ballots, which can play the role of spoiler, although not win. So Independence Party candidates do play a bigger role in Minnesota than they do in most states. The deck is stacked against Independence Party candidates. There's no doubt about it. So Independence Party candidates, you know, don't get they don't get as much money in the grant running for office. There's a psychological barrier. There are institutional barriers. It's harder to raise money. The U.S. system in general, with first-past-the-post single-member districts, is a two-party system. Where's your network if you're an Independence Party? Where's sort of the network that goes from election cycle to election cycle of people who are going to get out the vote for you? But one of the issues with the Independence Party is that, I mean, the way Tom Horner ran, it was clearly an Independence Party in the middle. That is very much the campaign he ran, the way he positioned himself. But that's not necessarily what the Independence Party always stands for. I mean, you think of sort of past candidates at the national level, and it's not necessarily that this is going to be a centrist party. And so that's sort of one set of complications in terms of the idea of compromise. And with ranked choice voting, I think if ranked choice voting had been in effect statewide, Tom Horner would have gotten more votes. I mean, I think that there's just no question about that. He was a candidate that appeared in all of the debates, very credible, was very engaged in all the policy discussions, taken seriously. So ranked choice voting obviously would have helped him. But having said that, I don't know that he would have won. I don't think so, especially because his support sort of never reached that critical 20% threshold. And if he hadn't been in the election, I don't know what would have happened, but I think it's very possible we could be talking about Governor Emmer right now, which is interesting because support for ranked choice voting has been much more likely to come from DFL elected officials, DFL party activists than it has from Republicans. And I'm not sure if that's sort of an ideological commitment to more opportunity for other candidates, or it's look what Peter Hutchinson did in 2006, to my catch. I don't know. I don't know what the motives are. But I think there is a question of fundamental fairness in terms of other candidates getting in the fray. But there's also an argument to be made that, well, why can't these battles be fought out within the two major parties so that voters really know from election to election where candidates stand? Because you pretty much know in an election, the Democratic Party candidate is going to stand for certain things and the Republican Party candidate is going to stand for other things. And there's going to be variation from cycle to cycle, but the idea of responsible parties sort of brings some sort of accountability from election cycle to election cycle, and then you can punish the party if they don't perform particularly well. And the Independence Party just doesn't have that right now. So Independence Party candidates, there's just less accountability. Now, your point that the party systems right now are nominating extreme candidates is accurate. That's certainly accurate, and I think that gave Tom Horner some room in this election. What to do with that, I don't know. So should people who are more centrist sort of fight it out within the two major parties, or should they try to form a third party in the middle? I mean, I would argue that it's better to fight it out within the two parties because that has collective responsibility from election cycle to election cycle, but it is also true that both institutional deck and sort of voters' own perceptions are stacked against third-party candidates. So it's sort of a long answer, but it's my thought on this.
Interesting answer, though. To the back here.
You raised so many interesting topics. It's hard to pick one to ask a question on, but your statistics indicated that Minnesota was first in voter turnout, 56%, mm-hmm. I believe, mm-hmm. and nationwide 40%, 41%. That still means in Minnesota that 4 out of 10 people didn't vote who are eligible to vote. And across the country, 6 out of 10 on average who are eligible to vote didn't vote. as a political scientist, is that just something that's accepted? Is it that's the way it is and that's the way it's always going to be, so that roughly half the people decide the fate, if you will, of 100% of the people in the country?
Great question. So there was concern among political scientists during, I would say, the 1980s, sort of late 70s, 1980s, early 1990s, that voter turnout in presidential elections in particular, but voter turnout had really declined since the 1970s, you know, post-Watergate. Trust in government is declining. Voter turnout is declining. Is this a crisis for democracy? But then we saw the election of 2004, a spike in turnout. Then we saw 2008, another spike in turnout. And, yeah, I mean, turnout of just shy of 60% in one of the biggest turnout elections in decades. I'm talking about 2008. It's not great. But it was viewed as sort of healthy enough because there's no evidence that the people who aren't voting are – massively unhappy or going to cause unrest. And so, sure, I'd feel better about democracy if more people voted and if more people felt like they had a stake in the system and wanted to vote. But by the same token, there has been some research done sort of under the rubric of what if everyone voted. And it's basically looking at the demographic groups sort of who don't vote and imputing people of those democratic votes proportionally who do vote sort of their preferences onto the people who don't vote, which is a very crude way of doing this. And basically, the political science research shows that it wouldn't really change the results all that much. I mean, it is true that people of lower socioeconomic status are less likely to vote. But having said that, because of intra-party competition and the fact that competition is channeled within two parties, that doesn't necessarily mean that election results are going to change because highly educated people are also more likely to vote Democratic and more likely to vote. So there's sort of a lot going on, but if turnout starts dipping and continues to dip, I would be concerned. But at these levels, it's actually relatively stable. And if people get energized about an election like they did in 2008, they'll turn out to vote. I wish all states had same-day registration like Minnesota, because that's one of the reasons that Minnesota's turnout is so high.
I'm curious. There were a number of constituencies who were greatly benefited, I would argue, by the Obama administration and this Congress. Those being, for example, the auto workers, those 30 million people who may now be included in health care. I think that's an accurate number. Perhaps we could also include college students with the loan program. That was a real benefit. And what I'm curious, if you're aware of any statistics, probably not at this point, that would determine whether any of those constituencies voted in greater numbers or lesser numbers this time, and also how they voted.
I mean, there's pretty clear evidence that every single demographic group voted more Republican in this cycle than it did in the last cycle. But what you're asking, I guess, is a differential in the direction that a group went more Republican if they were an affected constituency. And I don't know the answer offhand, but I think, I mean, this election, you know, was so much about the economy, even people who have been arguably sort of materially positively impacted in the ways that you describe, you know, sociotropically, still look at the economy and say, we're not doing so well, and I don't feel so good about the future of the U.S., and I think that is definitely a consideration. And then the enthusiasm gap, I think, was a factor as well. So here's an area where maybe the Obama administration could have been more effective in saying, I helped you specifically in targeting groups better. But Obama did go to college campuses.
Like here. It was a pretty exciting day. Where are you over here?
On the far right.
In the front.
Catherine, do you see anybody in the offing either in the Republican or Democratic Party that would be like a charismatic leader like Paul Wellstone or anybody that kind of gets people's blood going?
That's That's a really good and hard question. No, but if I think of someone by the end of the time I'm standing up here, I'll shout it out. And that's not to say that there aren't people out there who could be that person. I'll ponder that one. I'm feeling badly about this.
Let's go to the back here first for a question.
Do you have any insights on the role of the internet and social networking sites, if any, in the election results this time around?
That's a great question that is very ripe for academic research. Do I have any insight about this election in particular? No, only anecdotally. Only that, you know, Sarah Palin uses Facebook because it doesn't, because the media then don't get to interpret her message. And that politicians, are sort of competitive about how many fans they have. But part of what I suspect, although this is not based on academic research on social media, is the people who are getting the tweets, the people who are Facebook fans, the people who are really plugging in, for the most part, are people who are predisposed to already be interested in politics and like those candidates. But there could be a social diffusion effect where, oh, well, I don't really care about politics, but all my friends are sort of fans of this person, so maybe I'll join the bandwagon. Too early to say, and given what seems to be young people turnout in 2010, I'm a little bit dubious. There has been some research on the fact that in the cable network era, in which we are in, that because people have so many entertainment choices, that fewer people actually pay attention to political news shows. But among the people who do pay attention to political news shows, they are much more polarized because they now have polarized partisan choices. So, you know, liberals can watch MSNBC, conservatives can watch national Fox News, and, you know, there's less of the sort of, you know, in everyone's living room, same sort of mainstream, unbiased news that everyone's getting the same information. But instead, everyone's just confirming their pre-existing biases. So I suspect the same type of effect is going on in social media. Here's one area where the internet really has made a difference, and that's fundraising. That's clear, that the money raised on the internet has helped candidates, and especially because it can be instantaneous. You know, you see a politician on a news show, you can immediately either go to their website or their opponent's website and make a contribution.
We have a question right in the front here.
Thank you for coming tonight. My question is based on kind of the major swings this year, and given that the economy looks like it's going to be slow to recover over the next decade, does this mean that we're going to have some wild swings each election cycle, or is there going to be a gradual kind of a slowing down of these swings as it goes on?
Yeah, a great question that I can't predict, and in part because we haven't seen the new congressional districts. So one thing to look for is how many competitive congressional districts there are after the next round of redistricting, because obviously that affects how many swings there will be. So do states draw do they do partisan gerrymanders, or do they do incumbent protection gerrymanders? And we'll see what happens there. Tough to say. 10 years ago, political scientists were saying after the last round of redistricting, Republicans were going to have control of the House for sure until 2012. Then comes 2006, 2008. So I would say that, you know, dynamics change. There's movement within districts, within states. Even after the redistricting plans are set, there can still be movement. So anything can happen.
Do you have energy for two more questions?
Sure.
Great.
Follow the money. Got some changes. What's your observation? Do you know if this Supreme Court ruling is going to change politics, and particularly negative ads?
Well, independent groups before this cycle already were spending a lot of money, and they were already producing the most negative ads. So that was in play well before the Citizens United versus FEC Supreme Court decision. What this court decision did, though, was made it easier for corporations, labor unions, and other organizations to get into the fray. You know, it no longer had to be through a PAC. They could contribute directly to their treasury. And then the other issue is that even independent expenditures from groups, up until this cycle, the vast majority have been disclosed. But because many of these groups are taking advantage of the tax code to basically be a 501c4, a 501c6, like the Chamber of Commerce is a 501c6, and so because its main activities are not political campaigning, that means that it does not have to report its donor list to the FEC. Its donor list can now be direct corporate contributions, and so we are seeing more independent money and more untraceable independent money than we have before. But honestly, what I think is going to happen is Democrats are going to figure out a way, a better way to get more independent money on the Democratic side, and we're just going to see an escalation of spending. Because this cycle, it was about 7-1 Republican. And Obama was obviously very critical of the decision, but I think what will happen is Democrats will adapt. Because the Supreme Court, this is it so fundamentally sees the First Amendment as, you know, protecting all sorts of campaign speech that it's just really hard to pass reforms that don't run afoul of the First Amendment.
That $4 billion looking like a stimulus package in and of itself to me.
Yeah.
For the PR firms, I suppose. Yes, over here on the left.
Oh, first of all, thanks a lot. This has been most enlightening. Could you speak to the unhappiness, I think, with the bailout of Wall Street and why that seemed to then go in a direction I wouldn't have expected to vote Republican?
Yeah, that's in that, I think voters, I mean, voters were clearly very unhappy about that. But you're right. That unhappiness was certainly not channeled toward Republicans. The unhappiness has been channeled toward the president because the president is in charge. And I think voters' memories sort of about specific policies are relatively short. And sort of interpretation of bad economic times around them are driving forces in elections. And I don't think Democrats did a very good job at all of talking about those issues or about financial regulation legislation or – but to the extent that they did, I think it also just sounded like noise to voters who were just angry and riled up about the state of the economy to begin with.
Would you indulge us just one last question? And it's over here.
Looking toward the future, what is your estimate that the apparent tendency for confrontation and lack of compromise is going to lead to gridlock and potential government shutdown, either at the national level, as occurred in 1995, or at the local level here in Minnesota, as occurred in 2005?
Yeah, I'm not optimistic about cooperation in the next 2 years. Based on what we've seen in the last Congress and the Congresses for the, you know, 10, 15 years before that as well. It's only the polarization and the conflict is only heightening. And I actually believe that Obama was sincere about wanting to work with Republicans when he first entered office. I mean, he did show a lot of effort in sort of inviting Republican proposals. It broke down very quickly, and there's blame to be shared for that. But I don't see a lot of prospects for cooperation for the next 2 years. Again, the Senate in the last session had a record number of cloture votes and filibusters and, you know, didn't get a lot done, despite the fact the Democrats had 59 seats. Republicans pretty much unanimously voted against most of the president's agenda items, and I'm not sure why that would change. Having said that, things look pretty bleak for President Clinton in right after the election in 1994 and going into 1995. We had, as you mentioned, the government shutdown. It was sort of, you know, who's going to be blamed? Newt Gingrich, Bill Clinton. Ultimately, Gingrich was blamed. And Gingrich really evolved. And I think both President Clinton and Gingrich decided that they were both better off if they worked together and actually passed some legislation. Welfare reform, some minor health care legislation, balanced budget. So actually, the 104th Congress, an increase in the minimum wage, the 104th Congress, despite its very difficult start with the contract with America and a lot of confrontation between Clinton and Gingrich, actually wound up with some legislative accomplishments. Is Barack Obama as politically skilled in that way as Bill Clinton? I don't think so. Has polarization and the battle between the two sides gotten worse? Yes. So I don't know that Republicans would be willing to work with him in the way that they were ultimately willing to work with Bill Clinton. So I'm not optimistic about a lot of compromise in the next 2 years.
We all hope you get a good night's sleep tonight, and we thank you so much.
Thanks for being a great audience.
Arthur, you're being...